what's up, friends? Welcome to Rescue Your Own Damn Self, the podcast, where each and every week we take an epic journey down our own magical yellow brick road with kick-ass guests sharing their silly stories, awesome analogies, fearless failures, tragic tumbles, empowering aha moments, courageous comebacks, and legendary or even laughable life lessons. I'm your host, Lori Mork, and I'm fired up and ready to show you that you were the fierce warrior swinging the damn sword, slaying at life all along. It's time to rescue your own damn self. Andrew Hallam is one of the world's most prolific financial wellness speakers. He has spoken about money and happiness in 33 countries. That's more than any other Canadian. He's also the first person of any nationality to have a book hit number one in Amazon's personal finance and investment categories in Canada, the United States, Singapore, and the United Arab Emirates. He has been profiled on CNBC and the Wall Street Journal. He writes regularly for the Globe and Mail, and he's a lifelong fitness and travel junkie. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks so much for the invitation, Lori.
I'm so excited to have you here. You're one of my first male guests this year for 2022. And the reason your application, when you sent it to me to come on this podcast, you sent me a picture of you. Was it a crocodile or an alligator?
That was a crocodile. Yeah. And do you want to hear the backstory?
I do. Was your head inside of its mouth?
No, that picture, I'm on top of it. Like I'm
wrestling it.
Yeah, I'm wrestling it like Steve Irwin style, right?
First of all, I should mention as well, you're Canadian like me, British Columbian like me from the island. So wrestling a crocodile or, you know, we don't get brought up doing that.
A couple of years ago, my wife and I decided we would drive a camper van down to Argentina. That was our goal. And we spent 17 months in this camper van. And while we were in Mexico, we were at this crocodile, you know, I call it a crocodile farm. So it was really wild. We would walk across these planks and you can look down and it, of course, wildly unsafe, right? I mean, like it's Mexico. So it's crazy, wildly unsafe. You're looking down at these man eaters. They're monstrous. And they're in the rivers there, right? They're in all the local rivers and such. But anyway, we're walking through and you know how when they cool themselves, they just kind of sit still and they just open their mouths and they stay just perfectly still. And they're just, that's how they cool themselves, is just open up their mouths. Like they don't have the same kind of sweat glands that we do. So I went around the corner and I was with a couple of friends, actually a high school friend. And one of the reasons I love and hate Facebook, as most of us do, we kind of had this love-hate relationship with it. My wife and I were in Mexico, posted a picture, and this woman I hadn't seen in 20 years, who I went to high school with, said, "Hey, we're not that far from you." So we drove down, she and her husband were on vacation, and we ended up going to this crocodile thing with them. And she was really freaked, you know, just looking down at these things. And some of the boards you walk over are really sketch too. So I'd say it wasn't safe. Like there'd be, you know, cracks in them and such. And at one point there was a path and turned around the corner. And I was in the front and I jumped because there was this crocodile with its mouth open and it was cooling itself. At least that's what I thought. In reality, it was fake and it looked so real. It was fake. So as my friends walked around the corner, I jump onto the back of this thing and pretend to wrestle it. And so for a few seconds, they thought it was legit because they already think I'm a nut. But then we all had just a great laugh over it.
Well, the picture looked real. I thought it was real. So what would have happened if you had jumped on and it was just good at looking fake and it was really real?
I cannot imagine.
Oh my goodness. Well, first of all, welcome. I'm so excited to meet you. And we're going to talk about a bunch of different things today. But another reason that your whole story stood out to me is you were a teacher on Vancouver Island. And right now, as I'm recording this and we're speaking, you are living kind of, you're not permanently grounded, but you're in Panama.
Yeah, we've been globally nomadic since 2014. So I left Canada in 2002, and I took a deferred salary leave from my teaching position on Vancouver Island. So that was one of these. It was a really cool plan that any public school teacher can take advantage of if they know about the plan and ask for it and are so inclined. But you can have the school district take a certain percentage or keep a certain percentage of your income each year, sort of on a monthly basis. They take it out almost like a tax. And then at the end of a designated period of time, they give you the money back on a monthly basis and a full year off. So I was able to travel the world, and every month I would get paid. So I'd be like in Morocco and I'd go to an ATM and I'd say, oh, I just got paid. This is awesome. But I never went back to that job. So instead of going back to Vancouver Island, to that position, I ended up getting an email, ironically, while I was in Morocco. And it was the former school principal that I'd worked with in Courtney, British Columbia. And he said to me, and I knew he got this job in Singapore at a private school. And he sent me an email and he said, there's this position if you're interested. It's based on an American curriculum, mostly international kids. There weren't Singaporean kids in the school. So most of them were US passport holders, but there are 54 different nationalities represented in the student body. And the school had 4,000 kids from K to 12. So it was the biggest single campus international school in the world. So I never went back to BC. I went to Singapore, got this job teaching high school English, and then later high school personal finance. And that's where I met my wife, who teaches high school Spanish. And we stayed there until 2014. And then we decided we'd take 1 year off, which has led to two, then three, now seven. And so we've been globally nomadic since 2014.
Well, and for listeners that are like, what the heck does globally nomadic means? It means you don't have any roots anywhere. You're jet setting pretty much anywhere. You're not, because I asked you, do you live in Panama now? And you're like, we don't live anywhere. We live everywhere.
We would do in the very beginning, we left our jobs and we thought, let's do something really cool. Let's ride our tandem across Spain. And so we did that. And then we went to visit my wife's mother. We went to in the States. So my wife's mother lives in Pennsylvania. And then we went to Canada. We spent about a month there visiting friends and family. And then we decided we would go to Mexico and rent a place on Lake Chapala, which is Mexico's largest lake. And so we spent a few months there, just rented that place. Got into the community. It's actually the largest American expatriate community of retirees in the world. So it's very, very popular among Americans and Canadians. Snowbirds often come down and spend 6 months a year there. If they spend longer than 6 months a year, they jeopardize their medical status in Canada. And so they typically don't want to do that. The Americans, they don't really care about that because they don't typically have the same kind of medical benefits that we have anyway. So down there, you'll meet all kinds of retirees who are American, and you'll ask them, like, why are you here? And many of them will tell you, well, we're healthcare refugees. So it's a lot cheaper to get healthcare done there. But that was cool, like spending 3 months there. And we thought, you know, this is really neat. Let's go to Bali and do the same thing. And so then we did Bali, and then we decided we would do the same thing in Vietnam. And then we figured we'd do the same thing in the mountains of Thailand, in a really cool town in northern Thailand. And this was just it. This is just what we ended up doing. And as a finance writer, so I'm a personal finance writer as well as a teacher. And so I've been doing that for years. I started to get a lot of requests for speaking gigs. I think too, when people saw how flexible I could be with the schedule, knowing that, well, he's not really working on a schedule anymore. So let's see if we can get them to give a talk at our corporation or our international school. And so I started to do those really frequently. And that led to us going to places and seeing places that I never would have been before, that were in many cases, so many of them were super, super cool.
What's your favorite place that you've been to? Because you've been to a lot of places.
We have. And I think we get asked that question a lot, Lori. And I think that there's a bit of magic everywhere. So it's really hard to pick a favorite, but I'll give you like an underrated favorite. So I'll tell you about perhaps one that you might not have thought of, or the listeners, your listeners might not have thought of.
Because Bali, yes. Thailand, yeah. Yes. Mexico, correct. Like, of course. Check, check, check.
The country of Oman. Oman is, it borders the United Arab Emirates. And it is a really amazing place. So you think, okay, Middle East, not safe or dangerous. No, it's very, very safe. It's far from any of the, you know, the hot zones, both literally and metaphorically, because they actually get a winter. So this time of year, their winter is a little bit like a BC summer, but without the rain. And I don't mean like the BC summer you guys just had, where it was scorching, scorching hot. You know, I'm sort of talking about like generally BC coastal summer without the rain. So temperatures in the early 20s for several months a year. And it's blue sky and some of the best freshwater swimming locations you've ever seen, where you have water cascading down into pools and it's this amazing turquoise color. And it's not like, you have an area not far from Victoria, like the Souk potholes, which is really, really popular. And it's awesome. It's really neat. But the water is freaking freezing. Whereas whereas this water, you know, it's probably about 80 in Fahrenheit. I don't know why with water temperatures, I always think of Fahrenheit, but it's probably about 83 or 84 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's just super pleasant. There's never this like, ooh, you know, as you jump into it. And you can end up swimming into these little sections where you go into this cavernous area where there's a waterfall coming down, and you can climb up the side of it with this rope and jump down. I'll send you, when we're done here, I'm going to send you a video, or actually even just mentioning it, a really cool area is called Wadi Shab. I'll send you a video and your listeners, you've got to check this out. Swimming, just Google swimming in Wadi Shab, Oman. It's mind blowing.
And so now where is it in relation to like your Abu Dhabi, Dubai? Like, is it, where is it? I don't even think I've ever heard of it before.
Yeah, it actually borders. So it would be south of Abu Dhabi. So Dubai, or the United Arab Emirates, is made up of seven emirates. It's really like a country in itself, but it's made up of seven emirates, which are like, think of them as like provinces. So Dubai would be one. And then Abu Dhabi would be another. So those two border each other. And if you drive south from there, you'll eventually get to the country of Oman. It is, I call it the Philippines of the Middle East, or at least I call the people the Filipinos of the Middle East. And I don't know how familiar you are with Filipino culture, but Filipinos are givers. Yeah. They're just givers. I mean, they'll literally, like, they'll give you the shirt off their back. They'll give you their last piece of bread. Like, they're just so generous and generally a loving and warm people. And the Omanis are like that. It's just, you know, hiking with them, and you'll come across a family and they're cooking the meal and they're hanging out next to this river, and they might have driven in from the city and they've got this great picnic going on, and you're walking past, they will insist that you come and eat with them. And that's not rare. That's more the norm than the rarity. And it's like, wow, like when I left Oman the very first time, and I've been several times since then, I thought, you know, we need to learn a little bit from the Omanis. We need to learn a little bit. The Philippines is much the same. Like, if you go to a Filipino island, and there'll be a group of people eating and they're all together, and it could be a group of families or a village, and they've got this great meal going on together. They'll invite you in too. That's something I found so, so common among the Filipinos, especially when you get out into the provinces and into some of the islands, like outside of the cities. And it's something that I think we can take a piece of that. And
I feel like we'd get a weird side eye if we did it, even in Canada, because Canadians are definitely known as being quite nice and friendly. Mm-hmm. You know, as you know, a little bit nicer than, say, our American counterparts, which they would also yeah. agree to. They're the ones that always tell me. But I still think if I was like, come share my picnic, is this lady trying to poison me and put me in the back of her trunk? Like, I do think that we'd get, but I do believe as soon as you said that, I was like, I'm going to try to do that more. But if you see me on the evening news, it's because...
It's a funny thing. You know, you have these different cultures and these different levels of warmth. And there are stereotypes, but often those stereotypes are there for a reason. Like if you're in Eastern Europe, it's very much a culture of, you know, mostly stern faces, keep to yourself, don't talk to strangers, don't talk to anyone. And it's like, once you break in, once you really get to know them, and it does take a little bit of time, then you experience the warmth of, let's say, the Russians or like the Eastern Europeans. But it takes a while to actually break through. And I didn't think that, I thought Canadians were super, super warm. And then I traveled and I spent a lot of time in places like Latin America and places like Southeast Asia. And as did my wife. And my wife and I spent some time in Victoria. And we'd go to the local gym there. We'd sort of, oh, you know, we got gym memberships. We'd go to the local gym. And she'd say to me, Andrew, and she's lived out of the U.S. now for like her whole adult life. So my wife never really lived in the U.S. as an adult. And she said to me, Andrew, Canadians are supposed to be friendly. I said, well, they are. She's like, that gym, people aren't friendly in that gym. And I'd say, well, you know, what do you mean? She goes, you know, try and strike up a conversation with people, just with a random stranger. And I realized then that we as Canadians probably stick to ourselves more often today than I think maybe we did in the past as well. We're plugged into music. We're plugged into our iPods. You know, we're listening to, you know, people are listening to us. Maybe somebody in the gym right now is doing the bench press. Doing the bench press, and maybe somebody like my wife is trying to say hello. It's like they're just grinding out their reps or in between sets listening to us. But it did make me think. It did make me think that, yeah, I think spreading that kind of warmth and taking it, and even when you come across people that aren't necessarily warm and open, I think, you know, we're all warm and open inside. We just sometimes have to crack through, or at least make people comfortable enough first.
Well, and I think in Canada, especially at the gym, because that's my area, everybody's so busy. We're so busy. So we're so focused on this task at hand. And I was guilty of this too, with kind of having that resting. I got to get this done, power through. Don't make eye contact with me. Don't talk to me. But it was probably the last year, probably because of COVID and not getting to see people, that now I'm like, come talk to me, right? Like, I'm the, you know, yeah, I'll take an extra 5 minutes in between my sets to hear a story from you, because I realize we miss that interaction. We have to be kinder to each other.
Yeah, we need it, don't we? I mean, it's, you know, what I talked about in my recent book, Balance, is how we crave human connection. And that's one of the reasons COVID was so hard. It was the social isolation. And as people, we need to engage with each other. I mean, that's our reason. That's a raison d'être. It's what we are. We're social beings. And when we remove that essence, we really struggle. You look at so many of people in the nursing homes. There were people that died of isolation. My wife's aunt, for example, literally died of isolation because nobody could visit her for 8 or 9 months, which is a pretty miserable existence. And she, like so many others, just died. I mean, yeah, COVID ended up obviously wreaking havoc in nursing homes too, but so too did the isolation factor. If you really want to kill somebody, put them in a cage and keep them away from people.
Especially the extroverts. I'm an extrovert. And I mean, it was tough on myself and my son, because I like to see people. I like to hug people. I like to talk to people. And to have to stay home and not be able to come into that close space was tough. I'm going to come back to your book, even though I could make this whole podcast about you just telling me about awesome places you've been. I'll have to bring you back. And that's what we can literally talk about. Because as you're telling me about that magical place, I'm thinking, I want to know about Thailand. Now I want to know about Bali. Now I want to know about, but we are actually going to talk about finance, which is kind of, it's a different detour from that. But you have two books that are out. And the first one, I love the title of it. And it was The Millionaire Teacher.
Yeah. So the first edition of that came out in 2011. And then the second edition was 2017. So that was book number one.
I love the title because I have a lot of friends who are teachers and they're like, How's there a millionaire teacher? Like, what's going on there? What's the backstory? How did you come up with that? And where, what is the inspiration behind it? And what's the book about?
Well, you know, initially I wanted the book to be called The 9 Rules of Wealth You Should Have Learned in School. And my whole thing was, you know, when I moved overseas, and of course I was always, I was working as a personal finance writer. I would do freelance pieces for Money Sense magazine and for the Globe and Mail. And when I moved overseas, once people move overseas, they can't contribute to things like Canada Pension Plan or a defined benefit pension. So you could stay your career or work your career overseas. And if for whatever reason you didn't save your money, you could come back to Canada as a 65-year-old and literally get squat from the government. Like, you wouldn't get anything or very, very, very little. And the teachers that I would be working with overseas weren't getting a defined or contributing to a defined benefit pension, weren't contributing to the Americans, weren't contributing to Social Security. And so it was one of those things where, to me, it raised some red flags when I saw how many of my friends there weren't saving or investing effectively. So I started to buy a bunch of simple personal finance books and offer them to the teachers. And I spent thousands of dollars doing this and feeling like this was a great thing and people would be really happy and they would learn. And they were happy. They were really happy to receive these books. And then I decided to have these little book club talks where I'd bring people into my classroom after work and we would discuss them. And I found that most of the books, although they were the simplest books I could find, they were the concepts, the jargon. I mean, the teachers I spoke to said, oh yeah, we understand them. Until I started asking them questions, and then I realized they didn't really understand them. And then they opened up and said, yeah, well, actually, yeah, I was just kind of embarrassed to say I didn't really get it. And so I spoke to my editor at Money Sense magazine, and I said to him, like, oh man, I've spent like $4,000. I spent $4,000 on books. Like, I would go out and I'd buy like 40 of them. And then a couple of weeks later, I'd buy like another 40 and different books, different topics, or same topic, but different books. And he said to me, you know, you've got to try and write your own and use the people, like show them chapters as you go to see what they understand. And that's how I built the book Millionaire Teacher. And when the publisher saw the concept, first he said, you know, the 9 rules of wealth you should have learned in school. He goes, oh, that sounds more like a subtitle. And, you know, he'd read the introduction and I did start investing when I was young, when I was 19. And by my mid 30s, I did have a $1 million investment portfolio that was just built gradually, like not through any hitting any home runs or taking any crazy risks. It was just gradually compounded over time. And so the publisher came up with the idea of calling it Millionaire Teacher. And I cringed at that idea because it wasn't very humble. And I thought, oh, my parents are going to hate that. but it ended up being a really catchy title and it did sell well.
Yeah. And it's simple. It's a simple title that kind of piques your interest and has you saying, hi, I want to learn more.
Right. Yeah.
Well, the reason, and your second book is called Balance, which we'll talk a little bit about that after. But the reason that I like the idea of you teaching it is as a teacher, especially as a high school teacher, you're used to being in front of kind of a crowd that's very distracted, not really understanding what you're saying, but kind of listening. You have a lot of dancing to do in front of a class of, say, 30 high schoolers, especially in today's day and age. So you have a humor to it. And I mean, my accountant friends, my finance friends that don't have that side have the drier way of coming across. It's not that they're trying to talk down to you, but just a different way of explaining things. Whereas because you have your teacher background, an example, because I have a friend who is a high school teacher, teaching Shakespeare to a bunch of grade 11s or 12s, especially nowadays, because I was a Shakespeare, loved it. Understood it. I grew up in a Shakespearean town in Stratford, Ontario. Most teenagers nowadays, when they read Shakespeare, it's didn't understand a word they said. So you do have to jump through hoops and really, it's almost like you're making it a very complicated thing understandable to a group. And it's the same thing with finance. I don't understand a word about finance, But if I'm watching your jokes and your kind of song and dance about it, it's more fun. I'm understanding it. I'm not feeling so kind of dumb and alone in the whole thing.
Yeah, I think when you're communicating a concept, and again, it's probably even more important in this day and age where our attention spans are shorter, the idea of allowing people to smile a little bit as they go through it. So you're part entertainer. So a really good teacher is part entertainer. They have to be. They have to find ways to make things fun. And not like they have to always be the one standing on their heads or jumping on desks, which I did end up doing because that was a lot of fun for me. But but my writing and my teaching was often trying to find ways of bringing in analogies and bringing in stories to explain things and having a little bit of fun with it. And we remember those things. Like we actually remember the analogies and the stories, and things make much more sense to us when concepts are explained that way.
And so that book did amazing. And that was the one that was number one bestseller in business and finance.
Yeah, it actually got as high in the US on Amazon. It got as high as number 12, and which is crazy. There are 15 million books on Amazon USA. And for a short period of time, it was chasing 50 Shades of Grey up the charts, which was quite funny to see. And it was something nobody expected. So it ran out of copies, like they hadn't printed enough. And then they did another emergency print run and they all sold out. And then another emergency print run after that, and they all sold out. And it didn't have the lasting power that 50 Shades of Grey had. Obviously it didn't sell anywhere near as many overall, but I was thrilled. It ended up doing really well.
Isn't it hilarious? I just launched my second book last month and I actually looked at the books that I was kind of in the same, and I'm like, what kind of books, like what category am I in here? Like you kind of, but when you're up against, I was up against Will Smith at the same time. I'm like, really? I'm out at the same time Will Smith's putting out his book. Like it's neat to be the only Canadian to hit number one in that section. Again, because you're up usually against some pretty heavy hitters. You've got, you know, some of the Dragon's Den and Shark Tank guys that are releasing their books. You've got a lot of big, big hitters in that category. It's finance, people with a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of money to promote it.
Yeah,
exactly. You're bang on.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And so now your second book is coming out as this airs. It will actually have just been released. And I'm sure number one, hopefully beating the 50 Shades of Grey if they put out any new ones. I think we're over that now.
Yeah, exactly.
We're like, we just want to know how to balance our books and find money now. We don't want any of that. But it's called Balance. And because I had seen all of your adventures that you had gone on, I automatically thought it was going to be some, you know, finding yourself in Thailand, yogi experience somewhere. But it's a finance book. But it's a little bit different. The word success is kind of one that I'm going to throw around because, and first of all, some of your chapter titles were hilarious. Like, give me a couple of examples because I chuckled when I read because you sent me kind of a short. You have your humor in this book as well. And I loved that because that's what draws me is when I kind of skim the table of contents. And I was like, some of these look pretty fun, especially because it is a topic that money scares me. Finance scares me. And I liked that. I laughed. I chuckled when I saw some of the chapters.
Yeah, the chapter. Well, I think too, the fun part was some of the subtitles of the chapters, like describing the stock market and, you know, imagining somebody going to the bathroom. And so, you know, I described the stock market with a bowel movement, basically. And so just the idea that, you know, when you go to the bathroom, you're contributing to the corporate world. So, you know, how are you doing that? You know, so there's the whole idea of like everything from take the toilet paper, just simply take the toilet paper. So, you know, it's not just Walmart or whatever store that sells the toilet paper that makes money when you buy toilet paper. You know, so when you're driving to Walmart, you know, you're using fuel for your vehicle, even if it's electric, you're using some kind of hydro company. And so, you know, you're actually contributing to their bottom line. There's the, you know, there's Weyerhaeuser, there's all of the skidder manufacturers that are felling the trees, and there's the transportation of logs with the railroads, and just everything is so interconnected. And so when you buy a roll of toilet paper, you're literally contributing money to like hundreds of different businesses just through the process of buying a roll of toilet paper. And so the idea for me when I was describing this is, you know, you can own all of these businesses globally just through a diversified portfolio of what we call index funds. But you know, back to like, I think like my favorite topic, and you brought this up and you talked about success. And to me, I think we've got a really screwed up definition of what it means to be successful. And I found myself to be a little bit, I don't know if it's, you know, I'd meet somebody and they'd say to me, oh, you're really successful. And they would be referring to like the money aspect. And I'm like, oh, you know, society's got this so wrong in terms of what our perception is of success. Like, we'll look at somebody who, you know, will say, well, that, you know, that woman, she's super successful because she owns her own law firm and she's got a giant house on the hill and she drives a Maserati. But if you boil down our reasons for doing things, anything, whether it's going to the gym or running a marathon or getting a degree or trying to work your way up a corporate ladder, making a sandwich, anything. If you start boiling this down and asking, why are we motivated to do anything? The answers at first will sound a little bit different until you continue to dig with the question, why? So, but why? Why do you think that? Now, ultimately, it all comes down to either you're doing it because it'll make you feel good, it'll make you happy, it'll give you some kind of security, ultimately life satisfaction. So life satisfaction is the essence behind everything we do. Why do we raise our children this way? Well, ultimately it comes down to life satisfaction, right? So whatever it is. And so therefore, optimizing life satisfaction, that's what success is. Optimizing life satisfaction. That's it. Okay, so now we take the conventional definition of success, which is total BS, because what you can get is, let's assume that we have this person who's got lots of money and they've got their own law firm, whatever, they've got all this great stuff, but their relationships are a train wreck. You know what? Bottom line, when we look at life satisfaction and what research suggests contribute most to life satisfaction over anything else, it's a relationship we have with ourselves and with others. That's so essential. So what I did was I identified success as like a four-legged table. And you've got to have each of those four legs, you know, reasonably solid. So one of those legs is money. Like, you have to have enough money, obviously, so that you can feed yourself and you can keep your shelter, and enough money for healthcare and a little bit of money left over for some experience that you might want to enjoy, a little bit of a holiday. So money is one.
I liked what you said about money, that we often think we need more than we really do.
Exactly. Exactly. And we can talk about that, because that's such an important thing to talk about. The second leg of that table, that success table, is your health. So many of us, we know these people who are conventionally successful, but like physically, they're a wreck. And I don't care what anyone says, that's not a successful person. You have one vessel. Like, your body is your vessel. We get one. And there are a lot of things that we can't control with respect to our bodies. There are things, genetic things and this and that. But we've got to try and control what we can control. So we've got to try and eat well. We've got to try and exercise. We've got to look after that vessel, because it really is the only one we've got. So there's the money, there's the health aspect, there's the relationship aspect. And then the final one is a sense of purpose, like that thing that gets you up in the morning. If you inherited, you were born with billions of dollars, you wouldn't really need or feel like you needed to have a sense of purpose. And as a result of not having a sense of purpose, you'd often feel kind of worthless. And so the idea that we need something that drives us in some way. So some way of perhaps contributing. And this too is one of the things when we look at this concept of early retirement, so many people look at that grass on the other side of the fence and say, well, I'd love to be able to retire early. But the research on that is super solid. And what I find fascinating is that it's not more prevalent, like in terms of like people actually knowing it, but on aggregate, I mean, it won't be the case with everybody, but on aggregate, you retire early, you die early, on aggregate. Like, the research on that is super solid. So, I mean, one of the things that I recommend is, by all means, quit your full-time job if you've got enough money, if it's driving you especially crazy, and take up something part-time and something fun that you can do your whole life. So, I mean, if you're working super hard at something, like, I like what you're in, and everybody wants, you know, it's kind of funny because it's something that is portable. You can do it anywhere. You can help people with health and fitness anywhere. Yep. And it's engaging, and you have to keep learning. So you have to keep thinking, and you're going to be connecting with people of different age demographics, which keeps your mind sharp, keeps you socially sharp. So yeah, the idea that we should try to continue working, it allows us to maintain a sense of purpose, is really key.
Finding like a passion project, like it doesn't have to, it's not what's paying your bills. It's you can leave, say you have a 9-to-5 job you hate and it's causing you stress, to be able to find something that just drives your passion, and there's going to extend your life, right? Because you're still, you have a sense of purpose. I love the purpose one, because I've never heard that before. And I love the analogy of the table with the four legs.
It's funny, you know, I have a friend, he hates his job and he works for a city. So he's going to get some pension and he's got to put in like 5 more years before he maximizes his pension. And I say, look, dude, you hate what you're doing. And so think of it this way, you're basically prostituting yourself. Like, your employer is buying pieces of your life and you're hating it. So quit now. Oh, I can't, because, you know, I won't maximize my pension. And I say, well, forget that. Your life, you get one. And so why don't you start, instead of thinking about an all or none aspect, is that he loves bikes. Like, he loves bicycles. He loves being in bike shops. I said, pick up a job, part-time job at a bike store. You'd be awesome. You'd love it. And that would be your financial bridge. I mean, that would be the bridge between of income, you know, relative to you either, you know, retiring today on a partial pension versus retiring in 5 years on a full pension. And the idea too, I think, which is, I think, really essential, is recognizing, Lori, that we're all going to die and none of us know when. So, you know, the idea of, for some reason, you know, saving or killing ourselves to save money for some point in the future when we start living is insane. Knowing that, you know, I like to refer to life as like this hourglass, and it's dark. It's like the ultimate tinted hourglass. And when you're born, it gets tipped, but nobody knows how much sand they have left. And so, like, you have to live for the day, and in case you got a lot of sand, you have to sort of keep an eye on today and keep an eye on tomorrow.
Yeah, it's true. I had a chapter of that in my new book, because tomorrow's not promised. And that person that just passed away, it was something like 159,000 people die every day or something. And like, it was a big number. Mm-hmm. And they went to bed last night. They didn't know today was their day. You know, their savings could be huge, right? Because they were waiting to go to Mexico 5 years from now. They kissed their last, you know, kiss goodbye to everyone and didn't realize it. And there's something to be said for living for the now, to a point. You know, we're not going to live free and die hard kind of thing, but it makes sense.
Right.
What do you say to people that say, well, of course he says that, he has money, so he can say that, he's traveling the world. What happens to that person that, you know, is struggling with money and is scared of money and doesn't have that cushion?
Yeah. And of course I didn't always have that cushion, but the philosophy is so important. Like, having the right perspective on things is really important. One thing that you can do is, and I recommend this to everybody, is track what you spend with an app on your phone. Like, before we had apps, I used to do it in a little booklet, but I would write down everything that I made in terms of income and everything I spent, and I would categorize it. And apps are amazing for that, because, you know, you can go to the grocery store and then 5 seconds, just tap in what you paid for groceries, categorize it as groceries. And what a lot of people will do is they'll say to me, like, oh, no, I don't need to do that because my Visa does that. No, it doesn't. No, that's not the same thing. Because when you go to, say, Starbucks or whatever it is that you do, and you enter that money manually, like, you actually enter it manually, like, whatever it is that you paid for your latte, it starts to make you accountable, because it starts to make you recognize how much you're spending in each category. And when you look at those categories, it allows you to determine whether the amount you're spending is actually aligning with your value system. Like, you might see that you're spending a really stupid amount on something that really doesn't give you a ton of pleasure. There's another aspect of this that I talk about in my book, Balance, and it's that we've really become a culture of consumers. We are, the whole marketing corporate world is trying to convince us, and has successfully convinced us, that we need to buy stuff. And what happens, unfortunately, is a norm becomes established where we don't think we buy a lot of stuff because we live in a neighborhood where our friends all buy the same amount of stuff. But if somehow we recognize back down to that life satisfaction concept, that material acquisitions actually do not enhance our life satisfaction. And the research on this is robust. When you purchase something, it's like eating sugar. I don't care what it is. If it's a new car, or it's a new television, or a new phone, at first, it's a spike. You're excited about it. But then something called hedonic adaptability ends up taking hold, whereby after a few weeks, that new iPhone is just another phone. Like, it doesn't excite you any more than the old one did. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with cars. And it's not like, sounds like someone listening to this is might be thinking, oh, Andrew is talking really anecdotally. He's giving me his opinions. No, this isn't an opinion. That's what's really amazing by this. This is actually based on behaviorally scientific mm-hmm. research. So Michigan State University did a really fascinating study to see whether people who owned high-end cars actually enjoyed their driving experience more than people who owned low-end used cars. And they asked these people on a daily basis all kinds of questions, the people that volunteered for this experiment. And so obviously the subjects didn't know really what the researchers were looking for because questions came all over the place. What they really wanted to find out was, do they enjoy their driving experience more than people who buy cheaper cars? It turns out that no. It turns out that they don't. So the study was replicated in Germany as well, of all places, where people love their cars. If you ask someone, Lori, like they've got a new car, and you ask them, do you like your new car more than you liked your old car? They'll definitely say yes every time. Mm-hmm. And so Daniel Kahneman is a behavioral economist, and he calls this reflective happiness. It's almost like a justification. It's a protective mechanism. It's a rationalization of sorts. And you actually believe it. Like, we do believe it. So the belief is there when it comes out of a person's mouth and they say, yeah, I much prefer my top of the line Mercedes to that Honda Civic I had. They actually believe it. But research done, like if you could actually hook them up on a daily basis to determine like how much joy they're actually getting driving on a day-to-day basis, based on hedonic adaptability, they end up coming back to a base level. So what can we do for our financial futures? What we can do is we can decide to cut back dramatically on the stuff we buy because it doesn't enhance our life satisfaction. Now, to enhance our life satisfaction, and we want to spend money to do that, spend money on experiences. So spending money on an experience, that research suggests, does enhance life satisfaction. So Lori, when you and some friends get together and 20 years from now, and you're sitting around a campfire, you're not going to be talking about the stuff you bought back in 2025, the car you bought, or the new sunglasses you bought. You're going to be talking about the experiences you had, the fun things you did, the dumb things you did. You're going to be having laughs because our experiences become part of our identities. And so if we can spend money, especially when it involves an experience that brings people together that we love and respect, that's massive. It becomes part of who we are, our identities, our memories. And those memories often get better every year. The stories do anyway.
It's true. And I'm thinking about, when we're recording this, we're just close to Christmas. And I'm even thinking, because I have two teenagers, we buy them the gadgets. They want the new iPhone. They want the new, whatever it might be. If we buy experiences for them, sure, they're going to turn their nose up at it when I give it to them. But you're right. They still talk about the trip to Hawaii, 3-4 years ago and the funny things that happened. And it wasn't shopping in the mall in Waikiki. It was what happened on the beach, when we saw that turtle or whatever it might be. It is the experiences, even though we fall into that trap of online shopping and needing the next shiny thing and Do you feel like it's been worse because of online shopping? Because I can't even, I'll think about yoga pants and I'll get an email from the yoga pant company that says, we got your new color in your favorite style and it's here's your size. We already have your credit card information saved, add to cart, and it shows up the next day. It's so easy to get in that rat race of buy, buy, buy. I mean, you've got a glass of wine and you're online shopping, and before you know it, you're buying a whole bunch of stuff you didn't even need.
Yeah. And that is a danger. And I do think that that's a significant problem, especially when, you know, we really don't have the money. You know, mm-hmm. We're putting that on credit cards and then we're paying interest on that. And I think too, you know, I was never, you know, growing up, I thought a little bit about the environment, but lately I'm starting to really think about it. Like just the idea, you know, when I was researching for the book Balance and I was looking at just the cradle to grave journey of anything like a pair of jeans, something super simple, right? The cradle to grave impact is unbelievable in terms of like the cotton, for example, that's used, or the water that's used to grow the cotton to make a pair of jeans, and the toxic chemicals and the people that are working in there and breathing them in. And it's always some developing country, and the crap that's getting pushed into the atmosphere while they're creating these things. And then they take the jeans and then they rip them. That's another thing, like fashion. I mean, essentially they rip them. And we know what happens with the ripped jeans, right? Like eventually those ripsters start growing. But it's then the transporting of that stuff and the packaging of that stuff. And all of that just has this massive environmental impact. And then where does it end up? Like if we actually followed our trash, it would be super depressing to see in each case, like where our trash actually goes. Like even most of our recycling doesn't really get recycled. And when it does, that involves energy as well. And that in itself is a pollutant. So, you know, when I was writing Balance, I thought, holy smokes, just this whole concept of just being really, really aware that when we spend money on stuff, when we buy things, environmentally, it's actually really detrimental. So we have to be so careful not to buy what we don't really need.
Well, and I mean, I'm not going to say anything bad about Amazon because I'm holding out for that sponsorship, but I ordered a small little like cologne for my teenage son. And I'm not kidding. It was a sample size. And just before you and I went on to record, a big box I saw outside, I'm not kidding. It was, and I opened the box and I took all of this wrap out, tons of wrap, and found the little tiny box of cologne at the bottom. And I'm thinking, who did the packaging on this? The yeah. second box, it was the yeah. same thing. There was a small little kind of little doodad that I got for my daughter inside a box, inside another box. Yeah. And I just, that was not responsible of me is what I thought. It was, wow, I need to rethink what I'm buying because of how they're going to ship it to me, or there's a bigger picture beyond just me in this universe. So yeah. I could sit here and talk to you forever about this. So let's kind of wrap up. I have two things I want to wrap up with. What is Balance about? Because we have The Millionaire Teacher bestseller. What is Balance about? And it's coming out in January.
So it's really about those four pillars of success. And I think the notion of, I do show how to invest your money to beat 90% of investment professionals on about 10 minutes a year, like not having to follow the stock market or follow the economy. I show you actually how to do it both either on your own or with a very specific type of financial advisor. And probably one in 10,000 would actually fit my qualifications. Most financial advisors will sell you products, especially in Canada. So if you walk into a local bank or you walk into a local mutual fund company, they will sell you products with high hidden fees. They won't tell you that there are high hidden fees. They'll argue against their fees being high, but those fees erode your long-term growth over time. So I talk about the products to buy whereby you can be diversified, pay really low fees. And many people will think like, well, what's a big deal on fees? So in Canada, mutual fund fees are about 2% per year. And so the difference between someone paying 2% versus someone paying 0.2% at the end of your working lifetime can literally be the difference of you having $500,000 or you having $1 million. Like compounding money and compounding fees, it's dramatic. So I really wanted to take the stories and the things I'd learned from Millionaire Teacher and boil the investment part down into something that was bite-sized that people could really understand. But then throughout the book, weaving throughout what research suggests enhances our life satisfaction. So allowing us to spend, or if we are spending responsibly, it allows us to be better for the environment. It allows us to save more money. And I'm not suggesting we don't spend money. When we do spend money, spend it on experiences. And don't get so freaked out about having to hit a certain financial number at a given date, which a lot of people do. How much do I need to retire? You know, you see that online all the time where they'll say, you know, this study says that, you know, you can't retire on $1 million and all that sort of BS. Forget about that. Relax a little bit and try to think about following some kind of passion, bringing in a little bit of income when you're in your retirement years, because one, you'll stay mentally active, you'll stay more physically active, you'll live longer, and you're going to be happier. So I think, you know, where the book Balance, the subtitle is How to Invest and Spend for Happiness, Health, and Wealth. I really wanted to bring it all together as a packaged recipe for life satisfaction based on behavioral evidence.
I love it. I can't wait to read it. I know nothing about finance. And you told a story to me earlier about a mentor, kind of a guy that had lots of money, right? And I loved the story that you told me that he said, if I gave you $10,000, what would you do with it? And in my head, my wheels were turning, because a lot of us would say, go on a trip, you know, buy a new car or pay my car off. I like that you didn't say that to him. What was your answer to him?
I was a student at the time. And so I said I would put the money towards my schooling.
Well, and when you said it to me, I was thinking I would give it back to him and say, you do whatever you would do with it in terms of investing, or teach me, because that's what I want to do. And when you're telling me about this book Balance, I'm thinking I could actually learn this stuff, because I've sat here listening and I was not a good student growing up, trust me, about anything school related. This feels like something that could teach me, because I know nothing about it. But money to me also has to be part of health, happiness, all of that. And I love that you bring it all together, because I don't think we see that very often. It's money, success, make more. Here's what it's going to look like. And I like that you bring in all the pillars with it. And I can't wait to read it.
No, thanks so much. Yeah, looking at them in isolation is totally backward.
It just, again, it makes sense for, especially the feelers like me. Like money scares me. I don't know where to start. And that feels like it could kind of bring me in without overwhelming me too much. And who knows where I'll be in, you know, just, and simplifies it, which is what I need as well. And I can't wait. I'll definitely post up all the information about that. And I'm going to get Millionaire Teacher too, because I just want to read all of that too. Now I'm excited. Now I'm excited to see what is all in that one as well. My last question to you, to kind of wrap things up again, I could probably sit here for hours. You told me kind of the hidden spot. What's the most exotic spot you've been on all your travels that really wowed you, where you were like, this is the experience, your best experience?
Oh, that is going to be so difficult.
Or like maybe like top five.
Yeah, I'll tell you, there was a place in Guatemala that when we spent 17 months in our camper van, we ended up going to this particular place and we traveled down into this canyon and there was nothing around. It's just this dirt road. And then we ended up coming to this little village and there was a hostel there. So we were able to camp there at the hostel. It was like this open concept hostel with all of these hammocks. And it was just beside this gorgeous river. And we ended up getting these rides on these Jeep the following day to up and over these mountains into this spectacular swimming area. Often I think a lot of these places involve water. You know, like when you ask me, like the really cool spots involve water, and this just gorgeous turquoise colored water with these little cascading waterfalls coming down, and me thinking, how many of my friends have been here or have even heard of a place like this? And it's often those little places that no one's ever heard of that just end up having so much magic.
It's because it almost feels like it's your own secret magical space, right? When you go to Waikiki or Maui, I mean, everybody's been there before. Everybody's hiked Diamond Head, everyone. When you're in those little magical hideaways, it is like you're in your own little enchanted forest that maybe nobody else has encountered before.
And there are so many of those places in Mexico. Like if any of your listeners get a chance to drive around Mexico, like just so many incredible, incredible places, like fabulous cenotes, which again, these really cool sinkhole swimming areas. One of my favorite places in Mexico is a place called Bacalar. And it's, if you fly to, people often fly to Cancun. And if you rent a car and you drive south, eventually just before you get to the border with Belize, you'll get to a place called Bacalar. And it's a freshwater lagoon where the water is just this incredible turquoise blue, just this perfect Caribbean blue, but the whole thing's perfect Caribbean blue. Like the sun doesn't have to shine a certain angle for you to get this perfect shot. And the water's fresh. So it's just this giant, like a giant freshwater lake. And it has these amazing restaurants. It's really safe. It's really low key. They have all kinds of cool cenote swimming areas in and around it. There's so much culture and the people there are so cool. They're so nice. And of course, the people make it. Like in any trip, it's the people that you meet that really make it rich.
Have you ever thought of having a travel show? Forget about like wrestling alligators. I really like travel show, throw in some financial advice.
Sounds like a little bit of work.
While you're laying next to a cenote, like, I mean, I think that could be a thing, like on HGTV maybe.
You know, we met this family of Argentinians. And one of the things that I find really interesting is when you meet people who are traveling and they've been traveling for years, one of the first questions that comes up is like, how are you doing this? Like, how is it that you're able to travel? So this Argentinian family, they were on their way to Alaska from Argentina in a motorhome with their twin 10-year-olds. So they had a boy and a girl. They were 10 years old and they were kind of like homeschooling them. These kids were learning online. And I asked these people, like, what did you do for a living? Like, what is it you did? And they weren't like, you know, they didn't work in the tech industry and have gobs of money. They were circus performers. That's what they did. And they had this great idea where, like you suggest, they could create these little videos of their travels and they sold them to these Argentinian television networks. And so they'd have these, like every week, they'd have like a 10-minute little video that they would send down to these television programs, and their RVs was plastered with all these advertisements. And so they were sponsored. So, you know, like everywhere from the garage that did maintenance on their RV, they were plastered on the side. So of course this is all on Argentinian television. So they had fabulous exposure, and really they got the bulk of their money from these sponsors. They were just plastered with sponsorship. And so they spent, I believe it was 2.5 years doing this. And it's so cool meeting these people that just have such out of the box thinking. And honestly, they probably left Argentina with, you know, a couple of $1,000s. And that in itself is just shocking. But we met so many people who did much the same kind of thing, that they have this really cool out of the box way of thinking.
Well, it just inspires you to, you could do anything you want. If you have passion for it, get creative. Think up. I mean, that is a great story. That's a great, you can make it work and you don't need a lot of money. And who knows, the sky's the limit, what will happen once you kind of explore and go on those adventures, right? They were just searching for experiences.
They were. And like you suggested in your own book, and it's so true, you live once, right?
That's great. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed chatting.
If there was one kind of drop the mic truth bomb from you to kind of wrap this up, what would you say about success?
I would say that we have a super screwed up definition of what it typically means in today's culture. And it's seriously messed up. That's my truth bomb. It's messed up.
Well, and even just saying that, when you mentioned the four pillars, is that what you call them, pillars? I have pillars too in my coaching. I love that. And that the table, the four-legged table, I'm going to take another look at where what I view my vision of success, because I'm now thinking about my purpose. I'm now thinking about relationships. Purpose is new to me to see that, and it's going to change. It's going to definitely change even my, so we can rewrite our vision of success. Maybe we all need to take a little look at it.
I like that. And, you know, the Harvard adult study, or there's a adult study of development. That's a Harvard-based study. And they wanted to find out like the single variable, the single greatest variable for life satisfaction, what makes people happy. And they found that it was relationships. Yet we set all these goals, but how often do we set relationship-based goals? Like I set physical goals all the time. And I'm writing them down. I have a journal. I'll write down, this is what I want to be able to accomplish physically. People will do this with finances. They'll do this with careers. But how many people do we know that actually decide they're going to actually do this with their relationships? Like, this is what my goal is going to be. I'm going to make it attainable. It's going to be a SMART goal, or I'm going to be able to measure it. I'm going to be able to make it happen. And I think these are enjoyable goals to set, because they're super rewarding as you go through that process where you, like we talked about, you really work to engage with other people, because it's really all about relationships.
It is. And when I use it in my fitness and wellness coaching, relationships are, that's one of my pillars in my coaching. Because if your diet, nutrition plan, and your fitness plan don't support your relationships, I say the whole kingdom crumbles. You're the kingdom. Right. Ruling your kingdom is keeping, you know, you have your four-legged table. I have my 10 pillars. And if one comes down, the whole kingdom crashes. And relationships are huge. And we forget about that in our quest to be successful and rich, in our quest to be lean and have abs, right? Like, it's, we have to remember those people around us.
Yeah.
That's great. Sure. I finish every chapter in my new book with Rescue Your Own Damn Self. And I'm going to say, rescue your own damn self by redefining what success is, because we need to rewrite that, and keep your table balanced with those four legs, and buy balanced when it comes out, because it'll be out when this releases, and live sassily ever after.
I love it.
It's been great meeting you. And I really hope you'll come back on again, because I mean, I could talk to you forever. And I love hearing about your adventures. So now I need to plan some experiences. I have to go to all these places you were telling me about. So I definitely need to get my finances in order.
I would love to come back on your show and to talk. And, you know, experiences don't necessarily need to mean exotic places. You could learn guitar. I mean, that in itself, right? Just whatever it is, that something different puts you into something where you're learning something different with a group of other people. I think that's super cool.
Well, I'm going to for sure bring you on after Balance comes out, and I'm marking it in my calendar. What day does it come out in January?
January 18th.
Perfect. I'm going to mark, because we're in December when we're recording, to make sure that I share it on all my social media and get my copy. And I can't wait to bring you back on here to talk about it and so many other awesome things.
Thank you.
It's been great meeting you.
Thanks. Yeah, likewise. I really enjoyed it. That's one of the coolest things about doing something like this is, you know, when you connect with certain people and you know that you could have these really cool conversations that would go like on into the night, which is super, super fun.
It's amazing. It enlightens me I'm inspired. I'm so inspired by everyone in the world, but to come and finance, not my thing. At first, when I read it, I'm like, really? Like, I'm allowed to talk about money? Like, that's, and to see where this went, I just thank you so much.
Thanks so much for listening, friends. For more sassy and magical adventures, be sure to check out my website, lorimork.com, or follow me on Instagram at lori.mork. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, where each and every week we release a new episode featuring queens, kings, divas, vixens, gods and goddesses, and just some totally awesome guests who are ruling their kingdom and narrating their own feisty fairy tales. It's time to rescue your own damn self and live sassily ever after.